Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
People of the US, great news. The Formula One Circus is coming to Miami this weekend, and we've got everything you need to know on P1 with Matt and Tommy, the Formula One podcast from Stack. It doesn't matter if you're an F1 veteran or hardly watch a race. If you want a fun breakdown of the biggest stories from this weekend's race, we've got you covered. Join us for previews and reaction episodes from practice, qualifying, and the race itself, plus our full driver rankings podcast early next week. You'll be armed with enough info to make you look like a bona fide expert when the race rolls back around next year, or at least when you see your friends next week. Search P1 with Matt and Tommy in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now.
Austria was showered with swastikas. It was the 12th of March, 1938, and Hitler had finally emerged from his self-imposed inactivity. He crossed the border near his birthplace at Braunau. From the balcony of the Imperial Palace, he announced,
Als Führer und Kanzler der deutschen Nation und des Reichs melde ich vor der deutschen Geschichte nunmehr den Eintritt meiner Heimat.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Greatest Games podcast on Football Ramble Daily in association with the Blizzard. My name is Marcus Speller. Opposite me is Jonathan Wilson. And today on the pod, we have Kat Peterson, archivist, researcher and Blizzard copy editor. Kat, a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you.
Now, you've picked a right old historical one today. We go back to 1938, Austria 2, Germany 0. Why have you chosen this game, Kat?
Before I start talking about that, can I take you back to the absolute basics,
yes,
which is who's actually playing in this game?
You can.
So the game takes place on the 3rd of April 1938, as you may or may not know. On the 12th of March, the Nazis invaded Austria, mm-hmm, as part of their policy to extend Germany. The law was signed on the 13th of March, so strictly speaking, Austria by that point is already a part of Greater Germany. So when you say Austria playing Germany, they're kind of the same country at this point.
Okay.
So the people who are actually playing, even at the time, the newspapers found it quite difficult, mm-hmm, to give them a name. So they're being referred to as the Viennese national team, mm-hmm, because football in Austria was very centered on Vienna at the time. Teams from the regions weren't actually part of the league in any sense. So the Viennese teams were all playing each other. Mm-hmm. And they were referred to as Gau Österreich. Ostmark, I think by that point, wasn't used for the team. In the stadium, the teams were referred to as the German national team and the German Austrian team. So they're already right, sort of really pushing this Greater Germany myth.
Uh-huh. It's quite similar when on the Football Ramble during Euro 2016, when England went out, you know, Wales became England West as they've progressed through the tournament. As we very respectfully called them. So what were about this game as it captures your imagination then, Kat?
So I mostly came across this game when I was researching a player called Matthias Sindelar last summer. Mm-hmm. So he's a key figure in Austria at the time, probably the best striker in the world. He's been referred to in the 1930s. And both he and this game have been used first by the Nazis and then by sort of the opposite faction as myth-making
phenomena.
Phenomena. Thank you.
I was going to use the word propaganda, but phenomena is perhaps better.
And so it's really interesting, A, that this game was played at all, because the Nazis were not into football. Mm. I will say that. Like, they did not care. It was too dubious. It was a kind of alternative way for people to get attached to things. It was very regional in Germany at the time.
Well, I think as well, and we've talked with David Bolkov about this, that the Jewish influence over football in Central Europe in the 20s and 30s was enormous. Mm. So presumably that also made it suspect.
Yeah, and especially Viennese football, which is then really contrasted with the German football, which is much more physical, much more dependent on strength, playing a WM system, as opposed to the Austrians who are playing pyramid, very technical, fast, sort of almost tricksy, which obviously doesn't play well at all with the sort of Nazi ideology of people being physical and strong, and they don't want to see that kind of metropolitan.
Well, there was also a suspicion of
there was no two banks of four, was there, Jonathan?
Well, there's also a suspicion of professional sport generally in Nazi Germany, right?
That
sport was seen as something that should be pure, should be, you know, it shouldn't be something you derive money from.
Yeah, so in Nazi Germany at the time, football was still amateur. In Austria, it was already professional, and the Nazis then took it back to amateurism.
So Austria was the first professional league outside of the UK. So 1924, Austrian or Viennese football goes professional.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they're the first country to do that. Hungary follow in 1926, Argentina in 1931. I think they're the first three outside of the UK.
Good quiz question, that, isn't it?
Well, only for me. To be fair. and as Kat says, one of the things Nazis did after the Anschluss was to re-amateurise football, which actually has significant consequences for Sindelar.
Yeah, when we've spoken about the 1936 games, obviously held in Berlin on this podcast, when we talked about Austria beating Peru 4-2.
No, Peru beating Austria.
Oh, no, it was Peru. Sorry, I forget now.
Yeah, but Austria went through, which is why it's confusing.
Yeah. I'm getting caught up myself in the propaganda. How much of that do you think played a part? Because obviously the German national team didn't do very well. I think Norway put them out, if my memory serves me well.
Yeah, that's right. The only game Hitler ever went to, famously.
Indeed. So obviously that was amateur. It applies largely in the Olympics.
Well, completely amateur.
Yeah.
And properly amateur in those days. It wasn't like the... Yeah, it wasn't like communist times when you had what were de facto professional athletes, who technically their income came from being in the army, being in the police or whatever.
Mm. But did they see the way the football played out in that Olympic Games? You know, you saw, well, in the previous podcast we spoke about the Austrian and Peru and what happened there. 2 years later, you have this game in 1938. Why do you think that they needed to play this game whilst, you know, Austria had just been annexed, all this kind of stuff's going on? Was it just purely symbolic, or was it for people to try and rally behind?
Yeah, I think a lot of it was a very easy way for them to sort of give a feel-good atmosphere to boost morale. Of course, you have the implication that actually, if you call it the reconciliation game, which is what it was often referred to, that there is actually something they need to sort of make up for.
Reconcile, yeah.
Well, there's also presumably the fact that you have a World Cup coming up 2 months later where Germany will be competing with Austria and with Austrian players. So I guess there is a need symbolically to bring the two together, to acknowledge that this is not necessarily the most straightforward union.
Mm. And at the time, Austria were a superb team, of course, you know.
Probably past their peak by this stage, but yeah, definitely through, I guess 32, 33-ish is probably their absolute peak. But yeah, through the 30s, they'd been one of the great forces of European football.
Mm. And Matthias Sindelar, the great Austrian player, was at the centre of all this, as you've mentioned him already, Kat.
Yeah, can I take you back to something for a second?
Yeah, of course, yeah.
So actually what also happens in this game is that Herberger can see for the first time.
Go on.
The coach of the German national team, and he can see Germany and Austria play against each other. So for the World Cup that happens in June of the same year, he can then choose Austrian players to integrate into this greater German team. So we end up with a squad of 22 players, of whom 9 are Austrian, and they do appallingly badly. So this clearly didn't.
Yeah, I mean, I think
actually help.
If there's the a line I hadn't seen until I was doing the research for this from von Schammer and Dostin, was it Sportsführer? Was that his?
So the Nazi head of sport, yeah. Basically.
Sportsführer.
And so he's somebody who kind of crops up in various guises. He authorized, for instance, Alfred Schoffer, the great Hungarian, to go and coach in Germany. You know, he made sure he got his license, which wasn't a given. But there was obviously a recognition of how good Austrian football was, and if Germany were to do anything in that World Cup, they had to accept those players into the squad. And you know, he says Viennese football, or Viennese football art, and Viennese football and the Viennese football school are unique in the world, and we would be fools to destroy it. Which is a fascinating recognition, given it's to a large extent, a Jewish kind of construct.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not 100% a Jewish construct, but Austrian football, Viennese football as we understand it, a lot of it comes from Hakoach, which is a militantly Zionist team. You had to be not just Jewish, but a real sort of practicing, believing Jew to play for them. Mm-hmm. They raise money for Zionism. But also, Ugo Meisel, he set up the Austrian FA. He was the head of the Austrian FA. He ran Wiener Amateur, which becomes Austria Vienna. It was him who signed Sindelar initially and then seemed to go off him for reasons that aren't entirely clear. He signed the Konrad brothers, who were Jewish from Budapest. Yeah, he was the man who sort of created Austrian football. And there's the leading Nazi sort of acknowledging, yeah, we can't really do much at this World Cup without this sort of this structure that is Jewish in origin.
Well, it's a rare sort of moment of clarity, I suppose, from such a man like that.
Yeah,
he did say it in response to a lot of foreign press saying that Viennese football had died. So I think in a way he is sort of, it's reactive rather than him actually appreciating it.
So no, yes, you're right. But at the same time, I think the fact this game takes place, the fact that it's called Reconciliation, the fact that...
It's not called that by them.
Is it not called... Oh, so that Versöhnungsspiel is a later...
Yeah, not much later, but a little bit later.
Okay,
I think
fine.
They just called it...
But whatever they call it, it still appears to be sort of an acknowledgement that these two separate things need to be fused before the World Cup. And so that is acknowledging the power and strength of Viennese/Austrian football.
Mm. I mean, why do you think the World Cup was so important then? I mean, have they sort of looked at 1934, Mussolini, all that kind of stuff?
Well, it's the World Cup. I mean, even though it's only the third World Cup, it's still the World Cup. You still want to do well and you still want to win it. Mm-hmm. And particularly given the Olympics in 36 had been, an entirely a PR propaganda project, why would the World Cup be any different? And as you say, they'd seen the success of Italy in Italy in 34. And the way that Pozzo and his national team, I mean, I think there's a lot of debate as to quite how much of a believer in fascism Pozzo was, but certainly that team was sort of freighted with fascist symbolism and became a propaganda tool. Mm-hmm. It was clearly going to be the same in 38 and Italy do win it again in 38. So, yeah, you can see why people whose job was to promote Germany and promote the ideology that was running Germany would want them to do well in that World Cup, just as sport is has been a tool for states for 100 years and perhaps more.
Absolutely, yeah. And at the time, Austria, by 1938, the Wunder team, as they're dubbed, sort of past their peak. But in the early 30s, as Jonathan Sedcat, 1934 World Cup reached the semi final, and they were a phenomenal side with Sindelar, the most talked about player that they had.
Yeah, and one of the myths around this game as well is that the Austrians were told not to win. So it was actually meant to be this propaganda coup for Germans that they could say, great, Austria can do all these fancy things, but actually, we are the stronger power and we've sort of subsumed this now. Yeah.
So you're saying that's a myth, that the Austrians weren't told to kind of go easy? Because a lot of stuff you read about this, it's suggested that, come on, lads, that you shouldn't even score, let alone win the game.
Yeah, so there are a lot of myths about this, which is also quite interesting. I think the fact that these myths exist. So the main myths, as far as I can tell,
well,
have no basis in fact.
Well, should we come back to that? Should we talk about Sindelar and why he was so important?
Yeah,
Sindelar's key to the myths, right? So let's tease that for later. So I mean,
I want to get to the myths.
So the Wunder team, its birth is really when they put five past Scotland, and that is when Sindelar comes into the team. And so,
good Scotland side. People might think, oh, so what?
Well, but... I mean, a good Scotland side, except they had no Celtic or Rangers players, and they did get an injury very early, so effectively playing with 10 for most of the game.
Okay.
So there are, as ever with Scottish football, there are excuses. But it was the reaction of the Austrian papers to it is extraordinary. They sort of talk about, on the one hand, the excitement of seeing their team playing this beautiful football, and on the other hand, the sadness of seeing this great power humbled.
Yeah.
But I mean, Sindelar, I guess we should explain his background, who he is. So he's a Moravian Czech. His family is Moravian. They've moved to Vienna. And I mean, you've been to Favoriten, which is a suburb where he grew up. So do you want to talk a bit about that?
Yeah. So now a suburb at the time, now an area of relatively central Vienna, which was one of the sort of peripheral industrial suburbs at the time that starts springing up in Vienna at the end of the 19th, early 20th century. Favoriten, especially the Czech population there, based around brickmaking, which is what Sindelar's father did as well. So still clearly quite an immigrant community. And there what you find a lot is that a lot of Viennese footballers at the time come from this particular area for Vienna and a neighbouring one with a similar kind of structure. So almost a third of all players in the Viennese league at one point in the 1920s come from these two areas. Very much kind of children finding green spaces or greenish spaces for themselves to play in, developing their own style of play. Essentially, it's certainly been argued because they're not playing with real balls, they're playing with sort of rag balls, that they have to develop more technique. That a lot of them are undernourished, which is certainly true for Sindelar. So he's this very thin figure.
Is that why he got the nickname the Paper Man?
Yeah, partly that, is sort of dancing around the pitch. Originally, actually, quite a negative nickname, just because he didn't seem substantial enough, but literally because he grew up with not enough to eat. So you didn't have to make up for those facts.
But they were real street footballers. You know, we hear this about young working class, you know, in the neighbourhoods of, say, Buenos Aires or in South America more. They didn't have, maybe not so much nowadays, but certainly.
But I think that comparison is absolutely correct. I think what you see in Budapest, you see in Vienna, you see in Buenos Aires, they're cities that are, or countries where a city is growing rapidly. There's suddenly rapid urbanisation, people coming from outside, coming from the countryside, or in this case, from other countries to the capital. Other areas of the same empire. Correct.
Researcher and archivist Jonathan, we're dealing with a professional here.
The sort of the vacant lots where that seem to help develop technique, kids in poverty desperate to kind of, you know, I mean, Puskás famously, the reason he played football constantly was if his team won, they got given a salami and he wanted the food. But then at the same time, you've got that going on, the grunts, as they call them in Budapest, the potreros in Buenos Aires, which is sort of mythologized. And then you have, over the top of that, you have an intellectual culture, which somehow sort of, you know, there's a fusion of the two. So you get this sort of self-developed technique and this ability to look after yourself on the pitch, which you wouldn't necessarily get in the British game, where people were playing on huge grassy pitches, where running becomes the key thing. And this intellectual culture of the coffee houses, which, you know, that culture exists, Budapest, Vienna, Buenos Aires, they all have that, where intellectuals begin to take on the game and begin to analyse it and begin to work out a sort of tactical framework for it. And those two things together seem very potent.
But in Sindelar's case in particular, and Vienna in general, you get a literal connection of the two, because what happens a lot is that middle class, sort of socially engaged people will come into these areas and try and impose structure onto these street children. Or not, they're not street children per se, but children playing on the street outside. And one of the ways in which they do that is by establishing football clubs. And that's actually how Sindelar is spotted. So he's in this organization run by,
well, the team that he played for was FK Austria.
Yeah, and that's been an amateur, becomes Austria Vienna.
And a middle class Jewish side, weren't they?
Yeah, I mean, they were sort of
less Jewish.
Yeah, they were assimilated Jewish. They're sort of soft Jewish, and they're the equivalent of MTK in Budapest.
Right. Okay.
So you had the sort of the, I mean, terminology is very difficult here. You had the explicitly Zionist side, Hakoach. And then you had the sort of middle class bourgeois assimilated Jews at Vienna Amatura, but you know it would not in any sense be a 100% Jewish team. I mean, MTK I think was only ever about 40% Jewish. Well, I'm not sure what the figure is here, but my guess is it'd be roughly similar. So when the Conrad brothers move and they played for MTK, the reason they go to Vienna Amatura, it's partly because Hugo Meisel, who's this sort of great sort of, you know, just runs everything in Austrian football. Partly because he spotted them, but partly because it just felt very, very much the same. Very much, they're very much at home there.
Yeah. So Sindelar's playing on the streets in this neighbourhood, but he moves into football, you know, on a more professional base. I mean, he wasn't Jewish himself, as far as I'm aware. So hence what you're saying. But becomes this superstar of Austrian football and, relatively speaking, I suppose, of world football.
Yeah, absolutely. And like Jonathan said, one of the ways in which that is picked up because of this slightly weird environment in Vienna is that he becomes his hero of the coffee houses. So suddenly people are writing poems about him, which is, doesn't happen generally.
I think there's, you know, there's that, the Alfred Polgar, who was a theatre critic, who wrote his obituary in a newspaper in Paris, I think. I think it was a Parisian paper.
Seems but it, plausibly exile well, at the time. Yeah.
I think many people will argue who are listening.
But the way he describes him, I think you see why the coffee houses adopted him. So he would play football as a grandmaster plays chess, with a broad mental conception, calculating moves and countermoves in advance, always choosing the most promising of all possibilities. In a way, he had brains in his legs, and many remarkable and unexpected things occurred to them while they were running. Sindelar's shot hit the back of a net like the perfect punchline, the ending that made it possible to understand and appreciate the perfect composition of a story, the crowning of which it represented. So the coffee houses are places where intellectuals, playwrights, journalists play chess.
Yeah.
And he's describing him as a chess player and as sort of his comedian or writing a comic short story. Yeah. This is sort of projection from the coffee houses of, if we were footballers, this is what we would be. Yeah. That's why they love him. And you know, Di Papio Arena, the paper man, the fact that he has no physical presence, it is an intellectual form of the game. That, of course, makes him hugely appealing as well.
I mean, how important, though, when Austria went to play England at Stamford Bridge, they lost the game 4-3, but Sindelar was there and wowed the English press, did he not?
Sindelar was, you know, he gets dropped by, you know, he's sort of on the fringes of the Austria side through the late 20s. And Meisel, you know, who was his director at club level, is the manager of a national team. And he seems to fall out with Sindelar. So he had two centre-forwards to choose from. He had Sindelar and he had Uradil. Now, Uradil was a classic British-style number nine, big physical player. And I think there's a reasonable evidence to suggest that Meisel, because he was such an Anglophile, he believed that was how football should be played. So he was slightly suspicious of this new style of almost a false nine. But then there was a game when they lost, Austria lost 5-0 to South Germany, I think. And in January 1929. And Sindelar said afterwards that Austria had lacked Scheibelt, which would mean...
Have you got the pronunciation correct?
Scheibelt.
Yeah, I mean, don't do Austrian pronunciations because they're terrible. actually, so it's a verb. So they didn't Scheibelt enough, what he said, which is that kind of circle Viennese.
Oh, so the swirl, the Danubian whirl, which they became famous for, which he was sort of...
So what was that, sorry?
Well, so similar thing happens at Schalke, actually, a little bit later. And the base, it's just the false nine. I mean, you can conceptualise it in, you know, with modern terminology that the centre-forward would drop off and that creates a space, and that space then allows others to move into it. So you get this interchange of positions between the front five.
An element of total football.
To an extent. I mean, total football is a really misused term, so I'd rather not say that.
Okay. You haven't watched Fulham this season.
I'm afraid I have. total football was in its original incarnation, it was very much players moving in vertical lines. So the fullback would move, right back would move to right midfield or move to right wing. They wouldn't move laterally.
Right.
Whereas this is the front five interchanging. Mm-hmm. So it's different in that regard. The idea of interchange of positions, I guess, is similar, but there's no pressing behind or anything. So to call it total football, I think, is unhelpful.
Yeah.
He's saying that there should have been more movement. But of course, if you've got a manager who believes in a big, strong English style number nine, then you're not going to get that whirl. So I that seems to be why he was dropped. And then I guess this is again where the myths begin. But there was definitely a caucus of the coffeehouse writers who were pressing for him to be in the team. And there's a story that they literally cornered Meisel in a coffee shop and bullied him into picking, which I suspect is not true.
I've seen no evidence that it's actually true. It's one of those things that appears suddenly as a perfectly formed story and nobody can quite actually put their finger on where it happens. So
yeah, a bit of creative license there, perhaps. All right, let's have a quick break, and then after that we'll go into some of the myths a bit more.
Thank you. There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
People of the US, great news. The Formula One circus is coming to Miami this weekend, and we've got everything you need to know on P1 with Matt and Tommy, the Formula One podcast from Stack. It doesn't matter if you're an F1 veteran or hardly watch a race. If you want a fun breakdown of the biggest stories from this weekend's race, we've got you covered. Join us for previews and reaction episodes from practice, qualifying, and the race itself, plus our full driver rankings podcast early next week. You'll be armed with enough info to make you look like a bona fide expert when the race rolls back around next year, or at least when you see your friends next week. Search P1 with Matt and Tommy in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now.
Welcome back to Greatest Games on Football Ramble Daily in association with The Blizzard, everybody. Right then. So, 1938, so Sindelar, the Wunderb team, we've talked a bit about them. It comes to this match and they are asked slash forced to play this German side after Austria has been annexed by the Germans, of course.
Yes. So, there are four main myths that are really associated with this, all of which are probably not true, but I think the fact that they exist says a lot about what this game not necessarily meant so much to people at the time, but in retrospect, what people have attached to it. So the first myth, which is relatively quickly cleared up, is that Sindelar particularly arranged for Austria to play in their red, white and red strip, which obviously the Austrian national colours. The Nazis were very against using those colours because that would obviously give Austrians something to identify with, and they're really trying to eradicate this kind of, you know, that's no longer a country, you can't really have that anymore, instead of their traditional white and black. There's no way of saying that Sindelar had anything to do with the kit at all, for a start, and Austria had actually previously played in red and white. So, for example, you mentioned the game against England at Stamford Bridge earlier. That's where they played in red and white. So, this
so
is not,
yeah, it is worth mentioning that game that England won 4-3, but Austria played brilliantly, and the British press are sort of they lack a bit of punch in front of goal, but they are brilliant. So that was a game which sort of even the English who kind of thought all fans were useless to football accepted that they're actually really good. And eventually Austria do beat them in Vienna in 36, I think.
But later on they beat England when it was very in fashion to do so, didn't it?
So the actually what I would say that about that as well is that it was very symbolic for Germany to play in black and white because that's their home kit. So they're actually playing, they're not playing an away match. So Austria are using their away strip and Germany are playing at home, so to speak. So Vienna is also part of Austria now. And then the big myth really is that Austria were banned from scoring goals or that...
That's a very popular myth, that one.
Also that it was requested the result be a draw. So you could actually then have the propaganda sort of go whichever way suited you, so everybody was kept happy.
It's not the 1982 World Cup, is it? Come on.
So what we actually see in the game itself is that Austria do miss a lot of chances in the first half, to the point where a player, Binder in particular, sort of being encouraged by the crowd to wake up and stop.
So that's where that myth comes
chances.
From, probably.
Yeah, although I think if you're looking for that, then you obviously will interpret every single missed chance as something that was deliberately done. And I mean, there's no footage of the entire game, so I don't know if they've missed 37 chances. They missed four.
Maybe a very bobbly pitch, you'd imagine so back then.
Well, and also, I suspect a lot of the people who are coming up with these myths never saw the game.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of them will already be in exile, and it becomes useful to them to say this. So, you see fans now, they take one line of a match report. Oh, you see, this is what this means. People can spin anything out of anything, so... Yeah. Anyway, sorry.
So, yeah, then the, to go with that is then the theory that Sindelar deliberately missed his chances. And then in the second half that he, to sort of, you know, thumb his nose at the Germans by saying, oh, no, actually, if I want to score, I can.
Right.
So then suddenly they turn it up, which I don't, so the way the goals are scored, one of them is a sort of slightly odd.
It was Sindelar scores the first one after about 65 minutes.
Yeah, after 62 minutes, Binder hits the post.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was.
Über Wagner und Mock hat Binder den Ball bekommen. Kanoniert an der Stange.
Uh-huh.
Struck überlässt den Ball Sindelar, der aus der Luft für Jakob unhaltbar ins Netz schießt.
Yeah, exactly. That happened. Yeah, so Binder hits the post, the ball comes back, Stroh leaves it to Sindelar, who then scores. So that's not, from the description, it doesn't sound like it's a kind of technically particularly proficient, amazing goal.
Yeah, he didn't have to score it. If you're going on that myth, he could have quite easily put that one wide or not got on the end of it at all.
Yeah, and the second one actually sounds much more impressive. And Sester, who's the other Czech in the team, scores basically a free kick from 50 yards out, basically on the centre line. That sounds amazing. And the goalkeeper's way too far out, scrambles back, can't get to it.
Yeah. I mean, he's meant that then, hasn't he? You know, and you don't have to score that.
No,
exactly. From 50 yards out.
It'd be easier not to.
Yeah, exactly. Much easier. Take it from me. But yeah, I think the myth that they're not trying to score or anything sounds a bit...
Yeah, also in Herberger's memoirs, there's no indication that that happened. So they apparently, the one request was that the game be played fairly, and it was actually very low in fouls, so that was quite nice. People were applauding the sort of fair play of both sides, but there was no particular request for a result, and it certainly didn't go whichever way the propaganda wanted, if that was the case. And then the last one, which is related to the goals, is that the goal celebrations were variously interpreted as either being in support of the Nazis, so you have all the functionaries kind of, you know, on a balcony looking down, or that they were mocking them, you know.
Like quite defiant.
Whichever way, so that Sindelar runs into the centre circle and celebrates, and then obviously that can be variously interpreted as, oh, he's dancing around right in front of them saying, ha ha, look what I can do, or that he's saying, I'm part of this and I would like to pay my respects to these new overlords that we now have.
Yeah.
So, you know, again, yes, he celebrates in the centre circle, but how you want to interpret that really says more about you than it says about him, probably.
Yes, indeed, yeah. So,
and then, so, you know, 3 weeks after this game, or just under 3 weeks after this game, the Nazi authorities say, right, no more professional football, which is not because of this game. In fact, I'm sure this game is part of a, you know, a long process of how do we end the professional league. And so all contracts are to be cancelled from June the 30th. What that then means is that all these players have to suddenly find jobs.
Even predating that, the Austrian Football Federation has already been dissolved on the 28th of March, so a few days before this game takes place. So actually, even though this is, in theory, an international game, it doesn't show up in any of the stats because Austria were no longer a member of FIFA at this point. So the kind of return of football to a much more amateur structure is already happening.
And what Sindelar does, I mean, Sindelar's 35 by this point. So he's coming to the end of his career anyway. And you have to remember as well, 35 in those days was old.
Yeah.
Like really old. Very few players got past 30.
Well, especially the treatment he got on the pitch sometimes.
And I mean, it's more that he's malnourished and he smokes really heavily and drinks really heavily. I mean,
there's that as well.
If you see photographs of him when he was 35.
Yeah.
He doesn't look well.
He looks 50-ish.
At the bottom of a hill, yeah.
Yeah. So Sindelar finds himself, you know, without his footballing contract, he has to find a business. He decides to buy one of these cafes that Jews are being forced to sell.
Yeah, so he takes over this cafe that's already owned or temporarily owned by an Aryan Austrian. So because the previous Jewish owner had to give it up, but it was run as a cafe for Jews, which was then also wound up. So Sindelar takes this over in August 1938 and reopens it as Cafe Sindelar. So again, really playing on his name. Taking over cafes was quite popular by retired footballers because it was seen as something you could do without having too much knowledge or anything. You know, it would sort of run itself. I think especially if you attach a famous name to it.
Well, and he liked to have his name attached to various things. He advertised all sorts of things, from milk to watches was something I was reading about.
Yeah, a lot of advertising. He was in films, so he was really plastered all over Vienna.
He cashed in, but fair enough. You know, one of the best players in the world.
And he also, he didn't he agree some kind of deal to run the Praterstadion? Was it called that then? The main stadium in Austria?
So that's something that then didn't happen because of his death. So a few days before his death, he agreed to become sort of sporting director or a director of the stadium. So one of the, again, a myth associated with him is that a lot of people will say that, oh, Sindelar knew this cafe owner really well and he paid him a reasonable price. So even though this had to happen because of Nazi laws, Sindelar was actually helping Leopold Drill. And he was sort of making the best out of a bad situation for him. If you're looking at actual figures, it looks like that's not really true, that the money that he was paying was constantly being pushed down, that the valuation was being really taken not very seriously. Yeah. So he didn't really seem to do very much to encourage anything. But again, you can spin it in a way that he was supporting this Jewish clientele, which I think is then not really true if he's signing this contract for the Vienna Stadium, because that was definitely part of the Nazi structure, and he's really then buying into the new authorities. And while you can say that he was running a cafe maybe independently and doing his own thing, I think by the time that you're willing to become part of that bureaucracy, that's a bit different.
It's interesting you say that, because often, perhaps because people want to, they talk about him living a life in defiance of the Nazis and so on. But as you say, there's so many strands to this and so many ways you can spin it. It's quite difficult to sort of pin it down.
Yeah, I mean, I think had he not died when he did, maybe that would have become clearer. That I don't think in any sense he was an ideological Nazi. I think he just sort of went along with things.
It's easier said than done in the climate as well.
Yeah.
You can't. Again, one has to sort of word this correctly, but you know, to kind of use 21st century, you know, sort of, you know, in the society we are now, to kind of think of it as, well, he had the same choices as us. He had this, that, and the other. It's not quite the same.
I will say, so from what we can see from documents, he wasn't a party member, as far as we know, but he did vote yes in the referendum too. So there was this fake plebiscite where all the Austrians said, yes, we would like to be part of Germany, please. 99.75% voted yes.
Wow, so landslide.
That's also a complete nonsense to say, yeah, he voted yes, but, you know,
yeah, exactly.
Meaningless, absolutely meaningless.
Yeah.
And then January 1939, his friend Gustav Hartmann, he's supposed to be meeting one morning, doesn't turn up. Hartmann eventually goes to his flat on Annegasse, which is near the opera in Vienna, and knocks on the door, and there's no answer. And he eventually manages to break down the door, and in there he finds Sindelar and Camilla Castagnola, who was his girlfriend of 11 days, a couple of weeks. Lying naked on the bed, and Sindelar is dead.
Do you know that they're naked? Where does it say that?
Oh, maybe that's another one of the myths.
I've never seen that.
I have seen it, but I don't know for sure. And Castagnola dies on the way to the hospital.
She dies the following day.
Oh, the following day.
But without regaining consciousness.
Mm-hmm. And so you then get the question of, why is this 35-year-old athlete suddenly died?
So this is really dramatic summary by Alfred Polger. The good Sindelar followed the city, whose child and pride he was, to its death. He was so intrinsically entwined with it that he had to die when it died. All the evidence points to suicide, prompted by loyalty to his homeland.
And yet all the evidence doesn't really point to suicide, does it?
No, very little points to suicide. So it's now generally agreed that it was carbon monoxide poisoning, which can just happen accidentally. Yeah.
Well, there'd been a neighbour, I think, had reported a faulty heater
yeah.
a few days earlier. I mean, whether that's significant or not, I don't know, but it does suggest the faulty heaters existed in that building.
Yeah, and but because you can potentially identify it as suicide, or because it looks more romantic and more dramatic, and it does remove him in a way from the more problematic times that follow. So because he dies before anything.
But I mean, symbolically, it is a symbolically incredibly powerful image that you have this image of the old Vienna, and this man who's not about physicality. He's about art. He's about skill. He's about genius. He's not about the jackboot down the street. And on the eve of the Second World War, he dies by gas. You can see the power of that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it, but it also means that he doesn't ever get tempted, in a sense, to become part of that. So you don't
yeah, so
see
him...
Yeah,
so he remains pure Nazi.
Yeah, you
yes,
don't see
yeah.
him becoming a functionary mm-hmm. of the Nazis who might end up doing who knows what, because he's actually removed from that part of history early enough. And then he leaves himself open to all of these interpretations that you can put on it. And obviously, especially in retrospect, there were a lot of suicides at that time in Vienna. You know, it starts in sort of 39 with people being unable to cope with the life that they're being forced to lead. So it then becomes quite natural to interpret that as suicide as well.
One of perhaps the lesser credible myths, that's usually just a line written or something because it seems quite convenient when they're portraying Sindelar as quite a defiant character, is that he was perhaps murdered from the Nazis. But
yeah, and that's when, you know, it's all... And becomes tied into kind yeah. of, was he being provocative in the game we've been talking about?
Well, that yeah, one myth sort of then leads to another. Yeah. If you kind of go down that path of, yeah, he was taunting them on the football pitch, then it kind of leads you there. But ultimately, it's probably unhelpful.
I mean, yeah. the Chubby said that, you know, the police ended their inquiry after 2 days. They were convinced that there was nothing untoward.
Yeah.
But the one thing that is a little bit odd is that the public prosecutor keeps the case open for 6 months until they're told to close it by the Nazi authorities. Now, I don't know if there's anything suspicious in that, but it feels weird.
I honestly don't know anything about Viennese legislation about...
Well, if you don't, we don't.
...mortems at the time, whether that was just a period of time for which you kept it open.
Yeah.
You know, again, this is the sort of thing that, in retrospect, if you wanted to look dodgy...
Yeah,
sure, you can spin it that way. Maybe that's just officially...
The other slightly odd thing is, I mean, you've looked for the post-mortem and it's missing, right?
Yeah, but so I went to the state archive in Vienna, or the city archive in Vienna, and that particular post-mortem isn't there. So you go through the entire box, but there's also, judging by the consecutive numbering on the documents, there are quite a few that are missing. So I wouldn't say that one particular one has been removed. And, you know, I'm also an archivist, and things go missing for all kinds of reasons. Like, someone's just kept it folded up in a drawer rather than putting it back in the file where it belongs. It's been swept off a table for some reason. There's not necessarily foul play.
But it does create a vacuum in which myths can,
yeah,
can whatever things do in a vacuum.
Run wild and free. Yeah. But and going on that sort of train of thought, you know, that he was then, if the death was down to carbon monoxide, you know, he could have a state funeral, which I believe he did.
Yeah, so the Nazis then really took advantage of him dying almost and gave him this funeral with all honours. And, you know, the very Nazi mayor of Vienna gave a speech by his graveside. They had Hitler Youth turn up at the grave, and he was already described as like a blonde playmaker in his first obituary, just to really rub that in. Not that he had a lot of hair left by that point. And then gradually his grave becomes this sort of pilgrimage site, I think just from a footballing point of view. And the Nazis then put a stop to that because they think it's no longer appropriate to have that sort of emotional outpouring at the graveside of somebody when so many have died through war. Mm-hmm. So they had then sort of taken a step back. So the grave then just becomes, it's still quite a nice grave. I've been there. It's got a picture of him. It's got football, you know, all the kind of accoutrements that mm-hmm. you might expect, and now he's still one of the very famous players of Austria.
I think he's still considered the greatest Austrian player. The greatest player of the time when Austrian football was at its height.
I mean, they haven't they haven't produced that many compared to some of the other countries around them since then, I suppose. Yeah, I mean, you could argue, yeah. But still.
Tony Polster and Hans Krankl and people like that. But, you know, it's... He was the one who had them at a world level.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think he's... And you know, the early death gives people a mystique.
Yeah, and he does so much epitomise Viennese football as well, not just Austrian football as a whole, but he's really... a really key figure for Vienna that time.
So what's that? The term "Verschlampt"? I mean, no. Okay.
Your German's not as good as I thought it was, Jonathan. Nice to have you here, Kat, to pull him up on these things. But it's been fascinating talking about all this kind of stuff. And Sindelar, you know, one of the greatest players of all time, you could argue, and all those myths that have been busted on this very podcast, we can put them to bed. But it's definitely worth reading up about him and all those happenings around that time. So thank you very much, Kat.
You're welcome.
It's been a pleasure.
Don't beat Germany again for another 40 years. Yeah, there we
are. Well, for more stories...
Which is a famous game in Cordoba, which I hope we'll do at some point.
Indeed. Well, yeah, there's a call to arms for anybody. But yes, for more stories like that, go to theblizzard.co.uk. Thank you very much, Kat. Thank you, Jonathan, as always. Thank you, listeners, and we'll see you next time for another great game.
This was a Stakhanov production.
People of the US, great news. The Formula One Circus is coming to Miami this weekend, and we've got everything you need to know on P1 with Matt and Tommy, the Formula One podcast from Stack. It doesn't matter if you're an F1 veteran or hardly watch a race. If you want a fun breakdown of the biggest stories from this weekend's race, we've got you covered. Join us for previews and reaction episodes from practice, qualifying and the race itself, plus our full driver rankings podcast early next week. You'll be armed with enough info to make you look like a bona fide expert when the race rolls back around next year, or at least when you see your friends next week. Search P1 with Matt and Tommy in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now.